WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest Alan Alda has been acting, writing, and directing for American film, television, and theater since the early 60s, and he's on something of a roll these days. His recent performance on Broadway in the play Glengarry Glen Ross earned him a Tony nomination. He was nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal of a ruthless politician in The Aviator, and he's now a regular on the TV series West Wing, where he earned an Emmy nomination playing the Republican presidential candidate. Alda became famous in the 1970s playing Captain Hawkeye Pierce for the TV series MASH, which ran 11 seasons and earned Alda 25 Emmy nominations. He was the only person to win the award for writing, directing, and acting in episodes of the same series. Alda's many films include California Suite, The Seduction of Joe Tynan, The Four Seasons, which he also wrote and directed, Crimes and Misdemeanors, and Flirting with Disaster. Alan Alda grew up with parents who were traveling burlesque performers. His father, Robert Alda, became a successful stage and film actor. His mother suffered from mental illness. Alda writes about his life and work in a new memoir. It's called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. I spoke with him yesterday and asked him to begin with a reading. In this passage, he's describing his college days when his mother was troubled by his obsession with reading.
Ideas were an escape and a defense, and I holed up in my room reading for 6 or 8 hours at a time. My mother had never seen anyone do this before, and she became alarmed. She began looking into the books, trying to figure out what mysterious forces were taking over her son's mind. There was one in particular that worried her, a book on sociology that was popular at the time by David Riesman called The Lonely Crowd. She read a chapter and became disturbed. She called the college to find out if they had actually assigned this disgusting material. What about this word that keeps appearing in here, she wanted to know. Peer groups. Although she didn't say it aloud, peer groups sounded to her like people peering at one another. To the priest who answered the phone, the book and possibly all of sociology may have smacked of godless secularism. We're concerned about that book, too, he told her. Neither one of them was fully aware of what the other meant. Two utterly different forms of paranoia had met in the dark and agreed there was something under the bed.
Alan Alda, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Good to have you. You know, this book tells us a lot about your past and your family life. And one of the things I love is the your first appearance in a newspaper is revealed, which is then the Toronto Star. And this is a clip which has five pictures of an adorable 2-year-old Alan Alda with the headline Pipe Smoker at Age 2. And it says, for almost a year, Alphonse Robert Alda of Toronto has been smoking a briar pipe, and he's only 2 years and 3 months old now. When he became curious about his father's pipe, both his parents thought they'd let him try it, hoping he'd become sick enough never to adopt the habit. But he's been smoking ever since. A New York doctor told his mother moderate smoking would not injure his health.
I love that. Moderate smoking would not injure a 2-year-old smoke.
Right.
It's so great.
So what was this all about?
It was a totally fabricated event. I never touched a pipe. I drank a little beer with the comedians in the burlesque show, but I didn't smoke a pipe. And my father, and I remember this very clearly. It is maybe my earliest memory. I remember that he wanted to get the burlesque company mentioned in the newspaper when it came to town, when it came to Toronto. So he decided to make a good picture if he had me posing with a pipe. And the newspaper went for it. They sent a photographer and a reporter. And I remember posing for the picture in my little woolen suit. And I remember my father coming in the next day, showing the newspaper around, proud of getting them all in the paper with this story. And they didn't. He was a very creative guy. He wrote sketches with his partner in the burlesque company. And I could see, you know, at that point, I could see that even though they had told me not to tell lies, this wasn't telling a lie. This was just getting attention, and getting attention was the main thing.
Well, a theme of the memoir that you've left us with is your desire to really learn how to act. And you say that at a young age, you were privileged to stand in the wings of vaudeville houses with your parents and watch performances. It's a view that nobody else gets. And it, you said it was your first acting school. What do you see in the wings that tells you what to do, how it all works?
You get to see the performance from an angle that the actors don't intend it to be seen from. A really good example of this was when I was in vaudeville. My father was in vaudeville, and I was in the wings watching it. And there was a magician, famous magician, I think it was Blackstone, and I watched him from the side, from the wings, and I saw him take apart a card table, or a bridge table, I think it was, and he showed the audience that nothing was there that could contain any pigeons. But I could see that from the side, I could see that the table was thicker, the top of the table was thicker than the audience could see that it was, and I could even see the little heads of the pigeons that were hidden in it. And that's what I was able to get watching actors performing. I could see where they hid the pigeons. I could see the interplay between them. I could see the sweat flying off their bodies, the spit coming out of their mouths. You could see things that were really happening, that that were, on the one hand, obstacles to them to get through it the way they had got through it last night, and on the other hand, opportunities to get through it in a completely different way. When I stood watching Guys and Dolls in the Wings, which I did for Saturday matinee and Saturday evening performance almost every week for 2 years, I would watch my father acting with Sam Levine, and I felt that Sam Levine was a genius. I had never seen anybody play a part in a different way every single night. He would get laughs in different places, and yet he did it the way it had been directed. But he found variety within the structure that they had agreed on. And I just admired that so much. I wanted to be like that.
You were struggling to learn acting and get acting work at a time when you were a young adult, at a time when your mother's mental illness was really presenting itself. And you describe a moment when you first introduced your future wife, Arlene, to your mother, and she had a paranoid episode in which she was convinced Arlene was going to steal her recipe for Swedish pancakes, and it got to the point where you describe exploding in anger at your mother. And you note in this, in recalling this episode, that you as an actor had been trying to call on your emotions, and you found sort of ecstasy in the way your anger just overcame you at that moment, and you know, because it was so important to you, Arlene's impression of your mom. Were you somebody who had trouble reaching your emotions and your anger then?
Yes, I did. And it troubled me when my mother accused Arlene, who I was freshly in love with. We had just met, and I stayed in love with her for 48 years. But I wanted those 48 years to start then. And my mother was calling her a thief. She was going to publish her recipe for Swedish pancakes and steal it from her. And I felt this anger flare up in me, and I grabbed a candle off the table and smashed it on the table. And I was out of control, and it was like an ecstasy overtaking me. And it troubled me that I wanted to be able to call on emotions like that in a play when the script called for it, but it was hard for me to get in touch with those emotions. And now, conversely, here I was wanting to control my emotions and get through it with words, and I couldn't. I exploded. I was troubled that I couldn't hold back the emotion in that case, and troubled that I couldn't call it up when I needed it.
Well, you know, I wanted to play a clip from The Four Seasons, which I think is the first film that you both wrote and directed. I mean, this was 1981. Yeah. And for the audience who may not have seen it in a while, it's you and Carol Burnett play one of three couples who vacation together, and it follows the problems they have. And the scene I wanted to play here is a situation where the husband in one of these three couples has left his wife for a younger woman, and your wife, played here by Carol Burnett, is angry because you've gotten so competitive with this guy with a younger woman that in a soccer game that you've actually injured your knee, and the two of you are talking about it. So let's hear. This is my guest Alan Alda and Carol Burnett in The Four Seasons.
I also resent you for hurting yourself.
Oh, and that's not irrational, huh?
Do you think I like to see you so jealous of Nick that you feel you have to tackle him? You think that makes me feel good?
I think we should get to the heart of this.
The heart of this is that you wish you had some blonde nymph adoring you like he does. So go on, go find one. Christ, how long are you going to hang on to these fantasies? The reality is you're married to a middle-aged woman with a good sense of humor and dry skin. And if you don't like it, then go find yourself a nymph. Just do me the courtesy of telling me. In other words, and I mean this in the most loving way, shit or get off the pot.
Catherine, I'm sorry to say this.
What? Say it!
You're making me furious.
You're furious now?
I'm enraged.
How can you tell? I can't see the difference. Maybe you can learn to stamp your foot as a signal. Look, try this.
You shut up. You know how that voice carries?
When you're mad at me, I expect to see it. I don't want to have to read about it 2 years from now in your damn diary.
That was Carol Burnett arguing with her husband in The Four Seasons, my guest, Alan Alda. You know, it's a lovely written, a beautifully written scene, I think, and Carol Burnett plays it so convincingly.
She's wonderful in this. She made me laugh a couple of times. The engineer and I are both chuckling together.
Well, you know, and the interesting thing about that scene is here you are playing a guy who's having trouble getting in touch with his anger. And this is a scene this is a movie that you describe writing in your book. And I guess what's interesting to me about it is it seems to be a period in your career when, I don't know if this is quite accurate, but people saw Alan Alda as playing himself. I mean, you were this, you know, sensitive, caring guy who kind of tended to analyze things. Is that fair?
I don't think he was so sensitive in this. I think this is kind of a... an unflattering portrait of somebody, and although it was based on some attributes that I had at the time, and by the way, I didn't know I was basing it on me. That this is really funny. I wrote this part, and one day I said to my wife, "Gee, you know who this part is. You know who this character is. I think I understand who he is. I think it's my father." And she said, "You're kidding, right?" And I said, "No." She said, "You don't know. This is you," and I didn't know. I really didn't get it. Oh, it was my unconscious working. But this is not a sensitive guy. This guy overanalyzes everything and loves to make speeches and loves to control the situation to a tremendous extent. I don't know if that's me or not, but
He is, on the other hand, somebody who's very committed to his relationship and kind of believes in people working things out among them. This was done when you were in 1981, when you were very successful with the MASH series. And it's interesting, you know, when I saw your memoir, I looked up a 1981 New York Times profile of you in the New York Times Magazine, and it's interesting that was many, many years ago. And one of the things that the author observed was that you kind of objected to being regarded as nice. Something bothered you about being seen that way in films. And it strikes me that in a lot of roles since then, you've played some pretty not nice guys. I mean, in White Mile, you were this manipulative, ruthless executive. You've played a ruthless politician on The Aviator.
Actually, I think I've played all my life. I've played characters about half the time who were either very flawed or downright rotten. And because, you know, when you get famous, they attach a nickname to you almost always. Early on, a Newsweek interview with me, one of the first national interviews that I did after MASH hit, had in the headline, nice guy finishes first. And the writer of that article came up to me about 10 years later and said, "Sorry, I'm the one who did that to you." He got that nickname going of Mr. Nice Guy for me. And it stuck. And it stuck partly because... Not so much the characters I played, but when I came out and was interviewed, I would talk sometimes about the Equal Rights Amendment or something like that, and it would get me. It would sort of confirm the stereotype that I was too decent for words or something. I don't know. So I felt it did get in the way a little bit of me, of my being able to play a wide range of people and have people just accept it as a performance. On the other hand, you know what? It doesn't really matter. Look at why I wasted my effort getting worked up about it to the extent that I might have, because here I am. I'm 69. Look at the wonderful range of things I've been able to do. The fact is, if you keep plugging away at it, the work comes out.
My guest is Alan Alda. His new memoir is Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with actor Alan Alda. He's now appearing as a Republican presidential candidate on West Wing, and he has a new memoir. It's called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. Well, the MASH series certainly played a huge role in your career and image. And you, of course, played Dr. Benjamin Franklin Pierce, known as Hawkeye, which was, I guess, really at the center of that show as it came to be. You write in this book that there was something special about MASH from the very start. Describe your initiation to that role.
Well, my initiation to the part of Hawkeye was difficult because I was standing waiting for the first shot to be done, and I said to myself, I don't know how to play this guy. Who is this guy? How, in what way is he like me? He doesn't seem to be like me at all. I don't know how I can be him. And it was getting closer and closer, and I realized when they called action, I had to open the door and walk out, and all I had to do was cross the compound. But I thought, if I don't get across this compound without jumping into the character, I'm going to be me, and I'm not going to be happy. And a nurse was heading toward me, and I just impulsively, as she got beside me, I reached out and grabbed her around the waist. And she responded, and she patted me on the cheek and kept going. And I thought, well, I'm Hawkeye. That wasn't so hard. And from then on, I felt much more comfortable with it. But something happened that first week that we were shooting the pilot of MASH that was very important to us all, and to me personally. And that was that it was very cold in the mountains of Malibu. We were shooting in December, and we all had to wear Hawaiian shirts. We were playing a hot Korean summer. So to keep warm, we built a fire in one of those oil drums that you saw all the time on MASH. And we huddled around the oil drum and not only warmed our hands, but hugged one another, threw our arms around one another and kept warm that way. And that just brought us together as a group, made us a group, and we stayed a group. We seldom went to our dressing rooms. We sat together all day long in between shots. Sometimes it would take a half an hour or an hour to light a scene. And we'd still stay there and kid one another and get each other laughing. We'd also go over the lines, but it was mainly getting one another laughing that I found so valuable. And I do that every time I do a play now. I try to get people to sit with me before the show and laugh. And sometimes we laugh right up until a second before the curtain goes up. And that gives us a tremendous amount of energy. But most of all, it puts our attention on one another. And we've already been relating to one another. And now we just have to keep that going using the dialogue that's written in the play.
So even in a case like Glenn Ross, where it's not a comedy, you're not supposed to be laughing on the set, that creates that kind of focus that you need on each other to...
Yeah. But first of all, in our production, there was a lot for the audience to laugh at, even though it was kind of tragic at the end. But there was a case where the precision of the actors was extremely important, because everybody had to say his lines so carefully that the other person would be able to interrupt you in the middle of a word, then you interrupt them in the middle of a word, and it goes on and on like that. The rhythmic nature of that dialogue is vital to maintain. But nevertheless, having a spirit of playfulness gave us a chance within that formal structure to find variety and playfulness and the unexpected. And that's what made it very exciting night after night.
Well, you know, maybe this would be a good point to hear a cut from Glengarry Glen Ross, which you performed on Broadway. The one we have here, you're playing Shelley Levine, who is a real estate salesman who's complaining to his office manager, played by Frederick Weller, that he's hadn't been able to close sales because of the lousy leads he's been getting from prospective buyers. Let's listen.
Do I want charity? Do I want pity? I want sits. I want leads. Don't come right out of a phone book. Give me a lead hotter than that. I'll go in and close it. Give me a chance. That's all I want. I'm going to get up on that board, and all I want is a chance. It's a streak, and I'm going to turn it around. I need your help.
I can't do it, Shelley.
Why?
The leads are assigned randomly.
You assign them. What are you telling me?
Apart from the top men on the contest board.
Then put me on the board.
You start closing again, you'll be on the board.
I can't close these leads, John. No one can. It's a joke. John, just give me a hot lead. Just give me two of the premium leads. It's a test, all right? It's a test, and I promise you.
I can't do it, Shell.
I'll give you 10%.
Of what?
Of my end, what I close.
And what if you don't close?
I will close.
What if you don't close?
I will close.
Actor Alan Alda with Frederick Weller in the David Mamet play Glengarry Glen Ross, which earned Alda a Tony nomination. Alan Alda will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest is actor Alan Alda. He's written a new memoir called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. One of the roles you're now playing, and it's brought you into a lot of American homes, is your portrayal on West Wing of the Republican Senator Arnold Vinnick, who is the Republican presidential nominee. And I wanted to play a cut of that. And in this one, you as Senator Vinnick are meeting with President Josiah Bartlett, played by Martin Sheen, to work out a deadlock which has occurred in the Senate. The Republicans want a bill on the national debt ceiling, while the Democrats want to raise the minimum wage. So let's listen.
Mr. President, I'd hate to think that you were consulted by Democrats on the Hill about doing something as irresponsible as playing games with the debt ceiling.
Have a seat.
But I'd like to think they'd follow your leadership if we could agree on a way out of this mess.
You came to the right place.
Good. What did you have in mind?
Democrats withdraw the minimum wage amendment from the debt ceiling bill. You pass the bill, then you give them a vote on the minimum wage.
You'll lose a vote on the minimum wage.
We might be able to shame enough Republicans into doing the right thing in an election year.
How about you withdraw the minimum wage amendment? We pass the debt ceiling clean, then I round up enough Republican votes to pass the minimum wage increase.
You can get that done?
We have Republican senators in seven states with higher minimum wages than the federal level. California, it's $1.50 higher. We don't want jobs moving to lower wage states. I can get you the votes.
What do you want from me?
I announce the deal.
I know a few Democratic candidates for president who wouldn't be happy watching you take credit for this.
Well, then let them pass the debt ceiling for you and get you the minimum wage increase.
Anything else?
Help me keep a secret.
What's that?
That I just gave you more than you asked for. Let me hang around for a while. As if we're really slugging it out in here.
Can I get you anything?
Where's the ice cream?
My guest Alan Alda playing Senator Arnold Vinnick on West Wing. You know, it's interesting because in Glengarry Glen Ross, the Broadway play, you play kind of a guy who's sort of desperate, pathetic, struggling salesman. Here you're a guy who wields power with such ease. Tell us about getting into that role.
I just shook hands with the part of myself that's powerful and at ease with it. it's actually fun to get to be different kinds of people. I've always enjoyed playing somebody more powerful than myself and more at ease in an emergency, more of a leader and that kind of thing. And I found even in my 20s, when I would play a part like that, I somehow was able to take on those attributes in my normal life. The bad parts of the characters I played haven't stuck with me. I haven't gone on to be a homicidal maniac after playing one. But I did take on some of the stronger qualities. I think somehow playing it out, having the freedom to play it out and feeling the pleasure of it has sometimes allowed me to do it in real life. But it's not as if it wasn't there in the first place. That's the interesting thing about this process, this profession. You look inside yourself and find out, very often you find out what has been in there all along that seems so different to you and so alien to you. But we're made up of many different parts.
Does your wife, Arlene, know when you've brought a piece of a character home with you?
Yeah, unfortunately, while I'm playing the part, sometimes sometimes it shows up in the negative side of it shows up in daily life. While I was doing Glengarry Glen Ross, I was cursing a lot. You know, I'd go to hang up a jacket in the closet, and it would slip off the hanger. And you would have thought that I was being accosted in an alley, and I was fighting for my life, and I'm cursing and screaming, and yeah, and she, what? I said, a hanger fell. And she said, boy, I can't wait till this play is over. Because I was the guy all the time.
Well, I wonder if you're going to be acting like a commander in chief at home. You know, I have to ask you, Senator Vinnick going to be the next president?
I don't think anybody knows. At least that's how they're acting. They not only don't tell us, they don't act like they know themselves.
Alan Alda. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with veteran actor Alan Alda. He plays Senator Arnold Vinnick, the Republican presidential candidate on West Wing, and he also has a new memoir. It's called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. I have to have you tell us the story that forms the basis for the title of your book, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed. This actually happened, right?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, I was 8 years old, and I had this wonderful dog, a black Cocker Spaniel, and I loved the dog. It had been given to me to cheer me up when I was in bed with polio, which I had when I was seven. So I was all better when I was eight, and we moved to a new house. And the second day in the new house, we fed the dog some leftover Chinese food, and he must have choked on a bone or something. But he had an awful, painful death, and he died on the front porch. And I was really very upset. And my father thought, well, in order to help him get over this death, we should bury the dog together. So we went out with shovels over our shoulder, carrying the dog on a blanket between us. And we walked and walked and got to a field and started digging. Well, as we dug, I cried. And I cried more with every shovelful until I was hysterical. I couldn't control the sobs. So now my father really didn't know what to do. So he looked down at me and he said, well, maybe we should have the dog stuffed. And I didn't know what he meant. I didn't know what that was. So he said, well, take it to a taxidermist and they'll stuff the dog and then you'll always have him. And I thought that was a really good idea. So he took him to the taxidermist said, well, what did he look like? What should I make his face look like? What kind of expression did he have on his face? I honestly didn't know that dogs had expressions. I didn't know they had an emotional life. You know, he was a nice dog. He looked nice. So he did his work, and about 6 weeks later, the dog came back from the shop. He's sitting on a blue velvet board with this really hideous expression on his face. He looked like he was rabid, and he looked like he was going to bite you. And he had these glassy eyes I don't know how they did this, but the eyes looked like they were staring at you, trying to figure out where to tear your flesh apart. And I began to understand that you can't, I mean, I understood in a flash that this was not my dog, and it was not even a memory of my dog. It was a parody of this animal I had loved. To me, it was a person. And I realized, as time went on, I realized that certain changes you can't do anything about. Probably most change you can't do anything about. And death is the biggest change. And I looked for ways all through my life, especially after I almost died in Chile a couple of years ago, to see how I could take this big change of having my life given back to me all over again. How could I take that change and really get something out of it, really, really notice it. And boy, I'm really noticing it. I'm having the best time ever.
Well, you have to tell us, I mean, you got extremely ill while you were shooting an episode for the Scientific American series in Chile.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened there.
Well, I was on top of a mountain in Chile in a outside of a very small town. It was like the fourth largest city in Chile. And we were 8,000 feet up, and I was interviewing astronomers in an observatory. And all of a sudden, I got incredible abdominal pains. And at first, I thought it was chili peppers I had the day before, and I thought it would go away. But with every wave of peristalsis, I had a wave of pain that got increasingly unbearable. So they stuffed me in an ambulance to take me down to the town, about an hour and a half down the mountain on bumpy roads. And first they couldn't get the ambulance started. It was like a scene from MASH, and they were knocking on the motor. And I'm screaming in the back of the... if you look at MASH, you notice the people are never moaning. I did enough moaning for 11 years of MASH if they ever want to put it in. So we get to the hospital, and luckily there was an expert in abdominal surgery there. And he diagnosed it right away. And he said to me, here's what we have to do. You have a blocked intestine. And it turned out to be about a yard of my intestine that was dead. And he said, it's gone bad, and we have to cut out the bad part and sew the two good ends together. And I said, oh, you're going to do an end-to-end anastomosis? And he said, yeah, how do you know that? I said, oh, I did many of them on MASH. Isn't this amazing? And he had watched MASH when he was in high school. I mean, here we were acting out a scene from this thing that to both of us had been fictional up until then.
Right.
And now I was really living through it. And before I went under the anesthetic, it occurred to me that I might not wake up. And I called the producer of the science show over, and I said, I have some things I want you to tell Arlene and my children and my grandchildren in case I don't wake up. And it was very businesslike. I was surprised to see that I wasn't scared, because I'm usually I'm cautious to the point of being a fraidy cat. But I not only did I wake up, I had my life back, and I wondered how long this amazing feeling of being glad to be alive would last. And although I'm a little less manic about it than I was the week after it happened, I'm still thrilled about being alive. I'm noticing everything that's happening far more than I ever did.
And this was how long ago? A year and a half ago?
Two years ago, this October 19th.
Well, you know, I have to ask you about, this. You had this recent brush with death, and I have to ask you about the one at the beginning of your life. You were stricken by polio as a very young child and suffered through some very painful treatments as a result of that. I'm wondering, did that have an effect on... Well, it must have had an effect. How do you think it affected
you? I imagine it did. I don't really know what effect it had. Those treatments were extremely painful because it was the Sister Kenny treatment. She was the nurse in Australia who figured out a way to deal with the the paralysis in the limbs. I'm told by scientists now that may not, in fact, have been an efficacious remedy. I hope it was, because it sure as hell was painful. Every hour during the day, my parents, and it was my parents who did it, they couldn't afford a nurse to do this, they heated these squares of woolen blankets in a double boiler so that it was almost scalding hot, but it was dry heat. And they wrapped them around all my muscles. And it was so painful that this little kid, this 7-year-old kid, would be beating the bed with his fists and screaming. And while I was screaming like that, I was also aware that it was killing my mother or my father to have to cause me this pain, but that it was the only way they knew to make me better. When I remember being aware of how much it hurt them too. But I don't know what it meant. I think the aftermath of it was was more important to me. I didn't go to school. I was tutored. And if I was tutored for the year that I was bedridden, and then when I got better, it seemed more convenient for my parents to keep me tutored. And I didn't go to school with other kids until the seventh grade. And I really didn't know how to get along with other kids. I was the center of attention. I thought I was the funniest person alive, and I thought my job was to entertain them. Their reaction was that they thought their job was to beat me up, which would explain to me
which
that I was
to
not the center of attention. I had to learn either how to become a much better fighter or become a lot funnier, and I went for funny.
And it worked. Well, Alan Alda, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate you talking with me. Thank you.
Actor Alan Alda. His new memoir is called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned.